This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. Hello and welcome to our Market Talk Asia special. In this episode, we'll be focusing on the global macroeconomic topics affecting Asian investors. But we hope all of today's talking points, China growth, the Fed's aggressive monetary stance, the pressure building on the Bank of Japan, and how investors are factoring in inflation at the portfolio level will be of interest to all our regular listeners. And for this Market Talk special, I'm joined by two experts, Ben Bennett, Head of Investment Strategy and Research in Hong Kong, and John Rowe, Head of Multi-Asset Funds based in London. Ben, John, welcome to you both.
Hi, Francis.
Hello.
Hello, hello. Now, given the two key drivers of markets are inflation and growth, I mean, Ben, should we start with you and particularly growth in China? As a house, as I understand it, we've downgraded our annual growth for 2022. What's the driver behind that?
That's right. We've downgraded our growth forecast. Remember, the Chinese, their own personal growth target is 5.5% for 2022. We thought they would struggle to hit that. We had 5% as a growth forecast, and we've downgraded that to 4.5%. We actually think there's even potential downside risks to that. The major reason we've done that is the COVID wave that's hitting mainland China right now. Here in Hong Kong, we've had it for a little while, but it's starting to really spread, leading to some restrictions. We've seen Shanghai recently put in place a sort of semi-lockdown, so that's having an impact. And really, in order to hit the 4.5%, that COVID wave needs to be sorted out pretty quickly, and we just don't know if that's the case. The other reason why we think, you know, there are issues in terms of growth in China is that they're still trying to sort out what was last year pretty disappointing growth, and issues around lots of different factors, from the property sector to regulation and the tech market. Now, there was a speech the other day by one of the very important Politburo members, Louis He, who said that China is really starting to look at all these downside risks and will do something about them. And that was a big turning point in markets here in China. The Hang Seng, for example, in Hong Kong, which had been down just tremendously in 2022, just before he spoke. It was down about over 20% in 2022, just before he spoke. It's now down only 6%. It's had a bit of a rally since he spoke and since he put him, gave that rhetorical support. The big question now, though, Francis, is whether or not we're going to see action behind it. And that's still to be seen. But so far, there has been a decent market reaction.
I need to say, in addition to the monetary easing, surely we need support elsewhere in the beleaguered property market, in tech regulation. What's your view on that, Ben?
Yeah, so I think to start off with, the best signal will be on the monetary side, actually. So interest rates, that's always, people borrow money and they need to borrow it at lower interest rates, I guess, to support the economy. Now, the Central Bank of China had an opportunity just after the speech to cut interest rates, maybe just 10 basis points, for a particular funding auction that they did, and they didn't do that. We're now looking at sort of the middle of April for their next opportunity with an MLF auction. Will they cut interest rates then? If they do, I think that would be a pretty big signal, a pretty positive signal. Elsewhere, I think it's hard. Tech regulation, yeah, they could start to reduce the pressure, but it's still an issue. It's still something that's weighing on tech valuations. We'll see where they go. Property, they don't want to see the property sector run away with things again. They really don't want to get another boom going. And then the other part, which has really been weighing on, in particular, the Hang Seng, was foreign listing of some of these technology companies here in Hong Kong. They've been listed in the US, and the US regulator wants more data. China doesn't want to give the data to the US. Are they going to find a compromise with data? Again, that's quite tricky, isn't it? So anyway, that's all hard. Let's have a look at least for monetary policy and interest rates in the next couple of weeks.
Okay. And of course, it's a very different story over in the US, whereas in China, we've got that potential monetary easing that you've just spoken about. In the US, John, we've got quite aggressive monetary tightening coming out of the Federal Reserve, which looks as though some of it's been priced into markets already. What are the other ramifications of this hawkish pivot, John?
Yeah, so it is a lot, isn't it? You've got 8 hikes priced into year end. You've got about 60 basis points on 10-year yield. So it's not just the short end of the curve that's moving. And that's really off the back of this big inflation print, right? We've got core CPI, the highest it's been since the early 1980s. And not only that, we've actually got a US economy that looks pretty immune to in its sensitivity to short-term interest rate hikes. So traditionally, the sectors that are most exposed have been things like autos and home building. But actually, there's been real supply restrictions in both, which mean there's loads of pent-up demand, which actually means those sectors are nowhere near as exposed to interest rate hikes as they would be otherwise. And what this really means is that not only is there a lot priced, but there's a huge amount of uncertainty over how much is needed. And so that's make it very difficult for people to be prepared to stand against and stand against what's priced into markets, which means we're getting a lot of volatility. Now, ordinarily, you would look at that and you'd say, okay, well, more interest rate hikes, big slowdown in the economy, normally about 100 basis points of hikes is about 1% off GDP, but actually it could be less of an impact this time around for the reasons mentioned. And what does that mean? Well, it means that the US is going to be tightening global financial conditions. And traditionally people say, oh, well, if that happens, that's bad for emerging markets because they borrow in dollars and that's bad news. But actually what we've seen is emerging markets holding up surprisingly well. And there's really two reasons for that. First of all, a lot of this inflation shock is supply side. So it's higher commodity prices. And actually a lot of, particularly in South America, a lot of countries are commodity producers. They have net positive current account balances. And if you think about places like Colombia, Brazil, South Africa, and even Indonesia in Asia, that's the case. So for those, actually, the commodity shock's good news. And then secondly, whereas in the past, emerging markets have kind of hiked with the Fed, we've seen them getting ahead of the curve. So Mexico's already done 6 hikes since June, and the Czech Republic's done the equivalent of 17 hikes since June. So what does all that mean? Well, it actually means we think emerging markets are a lot less prone to this hiking cycle than they normally would be. And actually, given valuations, we're actually positive on emerging market debt as a result. So that's where you'd normally be worried about the spillover would be into emerging markets. And we're a lot less concerned in this instance.
All right. So let's talk about Japan now, because, you know, you mentioned dollar strength, you and John mentioned dollar strength there. Of course, the exact opposite in Japan, where the yen is really very, very weak against the dollar, had a bit of a bounce today, again, as you'd say, at the time of recording. But that's all, in essence, as I understand it, a reflection of the ultra loose monetary policy that the BOJ is pursuing there. So talk us through what's going on there then, Ben.
Yeah, it's the contrast between, as you say, the loose Bank of Japan policy and the big hawkish shift by the Federal Reserve. Now, I agree with everything John said in terms of the US economy being relatively immune to the rate hikes. It's going to take a few hikes to squeeze out US inflation and also emerging markets. You know, emerging markets are in a better state than they have been before, but there's always unintended consequence of the US tightening policy. And this is an aggressive tightening. So what we've seen in Japan, for example, is all of a sudden the difference in interest rates there at the 10-year point is even more stark than it is between, say, China and the US. I mean, Japan is trying to keep their 10-year bond yield at 0.25%. So that is pretty low. So if you're a Japanese investor, you're looking at the juicy yields you can get in the US, and maybe you move out, you sell some, you're selling yen, you're selling Japanese government bonds, and you're buying dollars and buying treasury. So we've seen big weakness in the yen. We've seen then the central bank of Japan, Bank of Japan, step in and try and support their bond market. So they're printing even more money in order to try and support the yield at 0.25%. And by printing money, that weighs even more on the currency. And you get this sort of spiral. And of course, if the currency keeps on weakening, and it has weakened by, as you say, a few percent over the last few weeks, then you're going to start importing inflation in Japan, and that'll put more pressure on Japan to potentially tighten their policy. So it's this very tricky situation. My fear is that spiral will continue to tighten over the next few days, and at some point it'll snap, and the Bank of Japan might have to give up on this targeting of 0.25%. This wouldn't have been the first time that a central bank has had to suddenly reverse course under pressure by markets, of course.
Yeah, but to your point, you can't really defy market forces forever, as I think you were alluding to Switzerland probably there. It was a much smaller economy, but, you know, that's what happened there. But of course, historically, so I hope I've got this right, you know, with the Japanese market, because it's jam-packed full of exporters, historically, a weak currency has been good for the for equities, at least.
Definitely from an export point of view. But then if you're a Japanese consumer, everything that you are importing costs more. Right? And actually, we saw that during Abenomics a few years ago, that it was undermined both by the, you know, they hiked taxes, but it was also undermined by the cost of importing stuff. Remember, Japan imports a lot of energy, so that's not helping to start off with, is it? That's the other point. So, yeah, it's the positives. Yes, there are, but there's always these unintended negatives. Like I said.
Okay, watch the space then on that one, I think, Ben. John, of course, we've alluded to inflation throughout, but it would be really useful to know your thoughts on, from an investor's point of view, and drilling down at the portfolio level, how do investors deal with these rising inflationary trends that we're seeing at the moment?
So I think the most important thing there is everyone starts from, is it transitory or is it structural? And the most important thing about that is not to talk about it. It's the wrong question, and yet it gets asked loads. So in reality, inflation's unbelievably hard to predict. So over the last sort of 10 or 15 years, just to give you one example, the Bank of England's inflation forecasts are negatively correlated to actual realized inflation. Despite all the money they spend, they'd have been better off not bothering at all. If you actually get away from that and say, let's not worry about if it's transitory or sustained, because it's been proven how difficult it is to predict inflation. And you say, okay, what questions do matter and what can we do about it? And there are really three questions that matter there. And the first one is, are you worried about a short-term spike, say from commodities, or are you worried about a long-term trend? Because in the former case, in the case of a short-term spike, it's things like commodities that work quite well, particularly as short-term jumps in inflation are generally caused by commodities in part. If you're worried about a trend, if you're worried about, I don't know, central banks letting it get out of control, then it's things more like inflation-linked government bonds that provide you with that steady kind of protection longer term. So you've got to really identify which you're worried about.
Which should we be worried about, though?
So that's really helpful, because that brings me on to my second question, which comes down to, do you believe inflation is controllable or uncontrollable? Now, if you believe it's controllable, you worry about the short term, because you know that the central bank will do enough to control longer term inflation trends. And I would say that the controllable matters more. And the reason for that is not because central banks are right, but central banks, despite their terrible forecasting records, believe in the empirical and theoretically questionable concept of the wage price inflation spiral. So they're obsessed with the idea that if prices go up and then people ask for higher wages, prices go up even more, wages go up even more. And despite the fact there was a Fed paper, I think last year, that basically highlighted this was theoretically questionable as a framework and empirically not supported, it still seems to be at the center of how all central banks react. So whether it's the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, everyone believes in this concept. And so because they believe they know how it works, they will always react to realized inflation by jacking interest rates. And if you jack up interest rates, you control longer term inflation. History would say you generally do too much and you cause a recession, but that's the price you pay. So you start actually worrying more about medium-term growth outcomes because of the central bank reaction function than you do about long-term sustained inflation. That brings me on to the third question. And the third question would be around, is it global or local? And we would say that growth investors, and most investors are growth investors, they own equities, they own credit, they own emerging market debt. It's global that matters more for them, right? Because if they get a bit of local inflation in their own economy, that's not the end of the world. If they get global inflation, that causes global central banks to react and tighten monetary policy. So that's the way that we would think about the three questions that actually matter for portfolios. So what does that mean? Well, it means that if you're worried about inflationary uncertainty, which we are certainly in the short to medium term, you prefer equities over credit, which we do, because credit's a nominal, semi-liquid asset. It's liquid some of the time, but in extremes, it really isn't. We then diversify as much as possible, because if you've got uncertainty in these different regions, then actually you just don't want too much exposure to any one region, because that's where it can go horribly wrong. You've just got lots in one region, and that's the one where inflation surprises and you get into trouble that way. So that's the way that we would think about it.
Can I ask a question, yeah, actually? I was going to ask about gold and even, I guess, like bitcoins and stuff. In the asset allocation sort of portfolios and stuff, do you think about gold in an inflation context, or is it just not useful for you?
Yeah, we do. So gold has a pretty strong relationship with two things. So first of all, the dollar. The weaker the dollar, the higher the gold price, because it's priced in dollars. So that kind of is the first driver. And the second one is actually real yields. So the higher inflation is relative to government bond yields, then the higher the gold price tends to be. So there's really three things going on with gold. The dollar. Now, if we were interested in the dollar, we could just take a view on the dollar directly. Real yields, which is the yield on an inflation-linked government bond. And if we were interested in that, we could do it directly. So then you're only left with geopolitical risk premium. And in extremes, there is that kind of argument that gold plays a different role. And there's also a more structural argument now that actually with some central banks seeing what might happen to their foreign reserves, Russia, for example, there might be more central banks that go, do I really want all of my or most of my central bank assets in a currency? Because that can be frozen. And that could cause more structural demand for gold. So actually, the biggest reason we'd look at gold currently would not be the dollar sensitivity or the real yield sensitivity. It would actually be that structural question around, are we going to see diversification of central bank reserves away from assets denominated in dollars and euros and into gold itself?
I was going to say, though, just picking up on that point, though, that given the geopolitical tensions we've had, obviously in Europe, you know, gold hasn't performed as well as you might expect, has it?
So gold and gold miners performed pretty well in the early part of the invasion. And that's what you tend to actually see in a geopolitical event. Gold tends to only perform for quite a short period, because then as the geopolitical risk premium gets normalizes, then you get a kind of normalization in the gold price. And we have seen it come off a bit as a result. I'd also argue that there's a lot further it can go. And the gold price's geopolitical aspect and exposure, it kind of picks up exponentially in the extreme. So it's almost like if you get people that trade things like VIX, the volatility of volatility, right? Then that's actually the kind of thing where gold kicks in. It's in those really extreme instances that it kind of behaves in a special way, because that's when everyone really starts to panic. And we're not really in that space.
That's interesting. Thanks for clarifying that one, John. So Ben, we've talked about a lot today. Just summarize your thoughts for us, really, about the investment implications, particularly from today's discussion, if you will.
Yeah, because it's easy to talk about a lot of stuff and then not actually think, what does that mean for portfolios, etc. So I think there's three things. The first thing is the contrast that both John and I spoke about between the US really trying to tighten policy and hike interest rates, higher interest rates, and China looking to do the opposite almost and support the economy. And I think it's fairly clear that from that perspective, we, in terms of our portfolios, prefer to take risk in the US at the minute over China, given the relative growth prospects. But you look, yeah, this could easily shift with how monetary policy and other policy could shift as well. So we're keeping a close eye on that. I think the second thing is that with the discussion about Japan, that I think there are going to be unintentional repercussions of the Fed's hawkish shift. And I don't think Japan's going to be the only one here. So this is going to create more volatility. That's opportunities, but it's also you've got to keep your eye on places where, you know, you want to pull back risk.
What you're saying there, Ben, is that risk is not specific to Japan. If the yield curve control gets out of control, you know, this will ripple across all global markets, will it?
Well, it's very hard to know exactly what the repercussions are. But yeah, when you see big spikes in volatility, often, yeah, people, some traders might have the wrong trade on, some investment banks, you know, some leverage in the system can be squeezed, etc. So yes, absolutely. It wouldn't necessarily just be Japan. It's the volatility created by that. Absolutely. Yeah, and then the final thing is what John was just talking about in terms of inflation and how impossible it is to predict. It's an incredible stat, isn't it, in terms of the Bank of England's failure to do that despite spending so much money. And hopefully John has given you a few examples on that, on how we look at it from a portfolio level.
Okay, interesting. Well, so it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, you look at the headlines and it's always the big question, is it temporary or is it permanent? And you've absolutely concluded that that is completely the wrong mindset. So if there's one takeaway for me, that's what you've underlined. Thank you for doing that and outlining the reasons why. Ben, John, great to have you on the pod as always. Thank you for your expert views and thank you all for listening.
Enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn and our website, LGIM.com.
Copyright 2021, Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, a licensed corporation, BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission. For professional investors only.